Good morning. How to create peaceful coexistence between Palestinians and Israelis has been a question without answers for decades. Hebrew University professor Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian is in Hawaii this week to talk about how to bridge the past and the present. She'll join us later this hour. Meanwhile, Honolulu's Chinatown seems to again be resurging. Improvement District President Lee Stack details the impact of some of the recent changes. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoop. Poet Joseph Stanton's new collection, Things Seen, builds on his responses to works of art and other media, from no drama to fairy tales. And yoga gets airborne in the challenging discipline known as acro yoga, a fusion of acrobatics with yoga practice. We'll hear from instructor Amanda Fergiuelli.
That's the conversation for Thursday, October 6th. It starts right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkoop. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning. Hoping for the best for everyone affected or who will be affected by Hurricane Matthew.
No kidding. And those who already have been in Haiti, which we know very little about, yeah?
And looking pretty miserable, I mean, when you think about what was in Haiti and
exactly.
The effect of this on those types of homes, if you can call them homes, many of them, and hoping that as we see this moving up the coast, as you heard in the news, that even those who have very well-built homes mm-hmm. are being told that they are very much at risk. And we have some familiarity with hurricanes in these parts, too, but very often trying to really understand that when then somebody says, you need to evacuate, you really do.
That's right.
But we're going to talk about an area that is seeing an influx of business as opposed to outflow this morning. That's going to be our first conversation. Now, if you walk through Honolulu's Chinatown at night, you see a very different place from the bustling business center of the daylight hours. Over its history, Honolulu's Chinatown has seen some better, some not so good, and some truly terrible times. At various points, the community has focused on efforts to clean it up, to make it more welcoming and safe. With homelessness, drug activity, and just general changes in the area in recent years, much of that work has fallen to the Chinatown Improvement District. Lee Stack is the president and charter member of the group, and she joins us now with a look at what's been happening quite lately. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've been watching Chinatown become sort of, you know, the hub of a lot of activity and events from things that, you know, First Friday that has been going on for a long time, and then sort of the outflow of a lot of the galleries that were involved with that, restaurants moving in, others, landmark restaurants moving out, people trying to do some rehab. It seems like the area really is again in flux, but it seems that this time there's a lot more emphasis being placed on how well that becomes a place where people want to go both day and night.
Yeah, I think there's some emphasis on nighttime activities for the bars and the restaurants. You know, I think they'd like, and the area around the theater. And that was the idea of the district when it opened on that side of Smith Street, was to be sort of a cultural district that would complement Hawaii Theater.
As you look at some of the historic buildings in Chinatown, because very much of what we see when we walk around, you see buildings with dates on them, and some of those buildings are in somewhat disrepair, and it's tough for people to maintain historic buildings generally. Is it any easier for those who are trying to get something to help them with, you know, preparing these buildings that obviously have historic significance?
Yeah, historic buildings traditionally have many, many challenges. They don't have the steel girders traditionally that modern office buildings have, and a lot of times they're built with wood, which in Hawaii is a huge problem with termites, and there's water penetration issues and all sorts of things. So in most states, they do they have tools for historic districts such as Chinatown, like state rehab tax credits, where building owners can get credits for some of the improvements that they do in their properties. So,
and in Hawaii, not so.
No, Hawaii doesn't have a state rehab tax credit. They had a low interest loan from the city, but that program was phased out. And there is a national program, a federal program under the Park Service, which is pretty stringent about how you restore your building, but they will give you a 20% tax credit for those repairs.
Has there been any movement to be able to bring that into Hawaii? And if so, what's that been met with as you've been talking to lawmakers?
Well, it hasn't. We're still working on the tax credit angle. The federal one, I think a lot of people didn't know or understand the program, and there really are sort of a lot of documentation to do. So I think a lot of people didn't take advantage of it, and maybe now more so there's more interest in these types of programs to help building owners maintain their properties.
For those properties, though, that are feeling the impact of homeless people who are there, we've talked a lot about people using, you know, stoops as bathrooms, and the fact that, you know, some of that has abated, but some of it hasn't. How is that continuing to be viewed and worked with within the community itself, as opposed to just calling the police?
Well, I think the community is vigilant in and of itself. You know, the merchants sort of have a network, and they work together on things, and people take pictures, and there's constant communication about things. We recently did a Taste of Chinatown festival in the Smith Britannia Park to create more activity in the park. And really have the residents use it. And it was really rewarding. The comments we got from people were like, this is what our park is for. You know, we want to come and use it. We made it a family-friendly, sort of kid-friendly day. And people were really excited about it. And they want more of that sort of thing, at least from what the comments that we received.
So how does that play with events, you know, Hullabaloo, the Mardi Gras, other parties that will virtually close down the area where, you know, there's a lot of drinking?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a sort of the legacy events, which you have Murph's, right, and St. Patty's Day, and he's been doing that for a long time. But I think with the other festivals, they were, from what I heard, getting larger and larger and sort of taking more streets and the impact on the residents and parking and businesses. So there were complaints. It was an issue, and it was causing a lot of neighborhood tension. So I think there's been more of a focus on sort of daytime activities. You know, bars and restaurants can always do things in the night, too, and have activities within their spaces that will draw people, like First Friday and the Art Walk. They had events in the art spaces and in the galleries. So,
but those have changed. I mean, we've watched a lot of galleries not be able to make it in Chinatown and go out. We've also seen restaurants that were there for a very long time, even starting for a lot of people when Indigo went out. That was a big chunk of Chinatown draw that was gone. Other things that have come in, certainly Pig and the Lady, others that are there, but there are spaces that still seem to be kind of crying for someone to come and take care of them, and some of them to be inhabited.
Well, I think there's sort of been a turnover. Usually with the larger spaces, they're more difficult to rent because it's a bigger risk for a business owner to take over and renovate the space. Smaller spaces, you know, like you see FET on the corner of Nu'uanu and Hotel, it's a very small space. Those are usually more affordable for people. What's nice about Chinatown is that it has a lot of small spaces that entrepreneurs can take a chance. I mean, they can make a go at it, but it's harder to do in a larger space, so those don't tend to rent as quickly.
Regardless of the space, taxes still are an issue for people.
Yes, property taxes in the Chinatown district. And this is another thing we're trying to draw attention to, because Oahu is based on a tax structure of highest and best use. And yet in the district, we're only, you know, buildings are only allowed to be up to 40 feet. So that tax, that property tax becomes a huge proportion of the building expenses. Whereas, say, on Bishop Street, where you have a 20 or 30 story building, that property tax will be spread over 20 floors. So
it's pretty difficult for people when they have to share it out over a couple of floors and those businesses. And yet there seems to be this movement to get the micro spaces and people who want to, you know, share a space just because they want to have a desk or an area there. Also watching the movement of, you know, people looking to perhaps, you know, live over some of the existing spaces in ways that go back historically for decades.
Yeah, a lot of it's sort of recycle, you know, the new is old and the old is new. Yeah, so you do have people looking to create lofts upstairs and live upstairs. I haven't heard a lot of them, but I've seen some of them. Some are very fancy, some are not so fancy. There's still Section 8 housing in Chinatown, so there is the single room occupancy. But there's also this move, like you said, to have smaller offices. You know, sometimes people don't need a really big office. They just want somewhere to sort of be able to meet with people and take a call and have clients come. So,
and just briefly before we go, I mean, a lot of concern over violence and drug issues that have been happening, deals that go down. People don't want to walk around Chinatown after a certain time at night. What's being done from the the business side of that to be able to make it a little more welcoming, because that's all part of it too, if they were looking to really bring people into their spaces at night.
Yeah, well, I think the general activity on the street with the restaurants staying open later, it means more people are in the area, so that's good. That's more eyes and ears on the street. And I think people are working with the police, the community policing team, to try to have a presence on the street and just be vigilant so that people will know people are watching, you know, and they're aware.
All right. So if you had to give some assignment to the health and well-being of Chinatown, what would it be?
Well, I would just say, it's a very, very interesting neighborhood with a lot of independent businesses that really drive the area.
And fun to walk around. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Lee Stack is a stakeholder in Chinatown. She has business and property there. She's the charter member, or a charter member, and president of the Chinatown Improvement District. The all-volunteer organization works on policy, beautification, preservation, safety, and economic development. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now almost 8:15. Coming up, a poet's reaction to things seen. But first, your backyard quiz.
Ulana, o mau, o kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
In 2006, state officials wrangled over HB 1982, a bill to permanently reinstate the Humuhumu Nukunuku Apua'a as Hawaii's state fish. Unbeknownst to many, the reef trigger fish had ceased to represent the Aloha State back in 1990, due to the expiration of a Hawaii state law. The colorful fish continued to hold that place of honor in public opinion, but the title came into question when a group of fishermen lobbied to have a certain endemic freshwater species named the state fish. For today's backyard quiz, what was this fish that might have represented the state? Stay tuned for the answer in the second half of the show. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right will get an HPR t-shirt.
Aloha, I'm Wally Amos. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Works of art are meant to inspire, and a great painting or a great play can set off a ripple of creative responses from other artists, generating a kind of wave effect that never needs to end. Joseph Stanton's new collection of poems is called Things Seen, and it's rich with references to arts as varied as no drama, fairy tales, and baseball. He's with us in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
What are some of the images, just talking about things seen, what are some of the images that got you going in this latest book?
Actually, quite a few paintings. I'm an art historian, so I'm interested in art, but of course other types of works. But as you mentioned, fairy tales, no plays, trying to kind of find what it is that, trying to grasp what it is about the work that either inspires me or, you know, that I find I can live in that work of art.
What are, just as an example, what would be a painting that you made into a poem?
Well, I've actually quite a few Edward Hopper things have come up. Mm-hmm. There's some personal connection I felt with his work, and two of my books of poems are quite a few Edward Hopper poems. It seems like maybe walking around New York City has turned me into an Edward Hopper aficionado.
That would do it.
Yes, I think one finds in some works of art a sense that one can sort of inhabit that space, that one sort of can live within that work of art and can find oneself in that work of art.
And then that needs to generate, ideally, that generates another work of art in which one can also live in a self-contained manner, yeah?
Right. And, of course, there are all kinds of ways to respond to a work of art. Certainly, people don't have to write poems or essays in response, but actually writing in response is one good way because, as I mentioned, if you grasp it or sort of take possession of the work of art for yourself by writing about it or talking about it, in a sense, it's become part of you in a very special way. And I get a pleasure out of trying to grasp and yet knowing that there are many other ways that that work could be grasped by others, but being able to enjoy my particular take on it.
Well, just the idea that you can get a grasp of it that others might not share, but that grasp, whoever's it is equally valid, kind of makes the work of art go on forever, in a sense.
Right. I think that we need to be audiences to the world. I mean, whether it's a work of art or just appreciating a tree or a flower or an old rotting automobile or whatever it is. I mean, I think we need to be alive to the visual experience. That's one of the ways. Or also, of course, sounds. Everything else that we do when we're alive is certainly one way of kind of finding our world.
Are you always looking?
Always looking, sure. Always looking, always listening, always smelling, always
tasting.
Do you
keep a notebook?
Actually not. I just write down on things that I happen to have available. I mean, I've always got paper because mm-hmm. I'm always writing stuff, but mm-hmm. I don't have like a diary or any specific things. There have been occasions where one of my friends made fun of me because I run into a restroom and use paper towels to write down something that occurred to me, or writing on paper plates when I'm driving in my car. Don't tell HPD that.
No, I don't think they listen. But at the same time, that thing of having a moment at which you got to write something down. Let me keep that idea.
Sure. Then there's that spontaneity. But then if you're interested in things like the arts, you also do a lot of research. I mean, mm-hmm. there's pieces that I've, you know, done endless research, read all kinds of books and articles, and yet I end up with a 14-line poem, which may seem strange, but it seems to me worth the effort.
That sounds like what poets are supposed to do, you know, that sometimes spontaneity in and of itself is not enough, right?
I think it can work both ways. I think one is aware, one is open to the world, and yet why not do research? Why not try to understand in every way one can?
Well, the first poem in your book, Things Seen, kind of set it up for me in terms of what the rest of the book was going to be like. So could you read that for us?
Yes, I will. The artist enters the scene and keeps right on walking. It might have been his masterpiece, but he could not leave it at that. Striding into a foreground of scattered, refrozen snow and a bitter cold that made the background sky above the horizon crackle blue-white with grief, he wondered why he had never realized how easy a journey it could be. But after years of walking, he could come no closer to the pale, distant mountains where God and his office staff might be waiting.
That one made me look at how the blue of a winter sky, you can just look at a picture of a winter sky and know it's cold, right?
Oh, yes, you can have that sense. Interestingly enough, this particular poem came off of a work of art that I am not even acknowledging in the title because the poem ended up being so different from the work of art.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't think the artist would even know that it was inspired by his work, but so because in this case it became something quite different.
Which is all entirely a valid part of the process, right? It's really about where it ends up, yeah?
Sure. I mean, I think you might write a poem in response to a work of art, but just like a poem about a relationship or a flower or a tree, the poem has to stand on its own. It has to be adequate as a poem, and it can't just be some sort of footnote or caption to some artwork or something else.
Sure. We also talked about you reading one of your Edward Hopper poems.
Yeah, I think I'll read this one. Early Sunday morning,
yeah.
A work that, interestingly enough, has a window where Hopper had painted in a woman in the window, but then for some reason revised it. But yet people that look at this work can see the woman to the sort of it's that has come forward as the painting has aged. So I use that to make a kind of personal connection to this particular very New York walking around kind of poem.
Mm-hmm.
Early Sunday morning. Nothing stirs on 7th Avenue but light and color, red so red and green so green, notes that complement the bright harmony the mind strives to see. A long-shadowed Manhattan morning, a subtly melodious 1930 of windows and doors that sing a broad expanse of street. But no one seems to be at home here, except the woman painted out in window 4, whose ghosted life returns now as pentimento, as she suddenly throws open her window and cries, "Oh, come in, my dear. It's been so long, and we have missed you so."
One of the things that I think happens in a lot of Edward Hopper paintings are you wonder what his people are thinking, right?
Right.
You see a woman sitting alone in a diner. Is she lonely? Is she, you know, what's going on in her mind? But that's a really special quality for an artist to make you care about a, you know, a lone figure like that.
And, of course, Hopper was sensitive. He didn't want people to know he'd had a background in illustration. He did not want people to think of the works as illustrations. But interestingly enough, Edward and his wife, Jo, they talked about who these people were, and they even gave them names.
Mm-hmm.
We now have their notebooks that show, you know, kind of the little stories. Often his wife, Jo, was the one that made up the story. Edward would talk about what colors he used and stuff, but she would make up names for the characters and do what a lot of the rest of us have been doing, trying to, with Nighthawks, one of his poems, I actually wrote three different poems inspired by it so that there's actually different takes on Nighthawk just from me alone.
Well, it certainly would be nice to get other people looking at art and thinking in terms of what they could do in response, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think it's our relationship with art should be active. We should not be just sort of like walking through a museum just sort of passively or
yeah.
listening to music and just passively. We should be active in our response.
I quite agree. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Joseph Stanton's new collection of poems is called Things Seen, published by the Brick Road Poetry Press.
HPR's sustaining members are the bedrock of HPR support. They know their monthly gift stream, a steady, predictable income to the station, and that we couldn't survive without it. Sustainers are a big part of the reason HPR can come to you daily, so please pledge $10 a month or more to keep your public radio station strong. Call us at 955-8821 or become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. About a month ago, in the waters of the federally protected Papahānaumokuakea Monument, a boat capsized. It left behind an excavator, fuel, and other items off Kirai Atoll, and the spill is still raising questions. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair takes a look in today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
So what happened? Why did this boat capsize?
Well, we're not entirely sure what happened. There is an investigation that is continuing. Two of the 9 crew members were actually injured and taken care of at a hospital. Kirai Atoll is all the way at the very end of Papahānaumokuakea, 1,400 miles northwest of Honolulu. So logistics is playing a role here. It's tricky to get out there physically to find out what's going on. But we do know that this boat was from a Hawaii company that was doing cleanup work for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at the atoll. Specifically, they were digging up PCP, PCB, rather, contaminated soil. That's highly toxic chemical compounds, PCB. And they were removing them from a site near the shoreline and moving it to another area, reason being that with the rising tides, sea levels, the concern is that those PCBs would leak into the water. But somewhere along the way, this boat capsized, and we're trying to figure out exactly what happened.
So here we are, a month down the line, and all that debris is still there. Who's responsible for cleaning that up? Is that something that is administrated through DLNR?
The DLNR is certainly playing a role there in the cleanup. That agency provided a number of photos, by the way, which are Nathan Eagle's story to help visualize this. The excavator that was being used, it's big. It's 8,000 pounds, and it's leaking diesel fuel and hydraulic fluid. Certainly that is harmful to such a pristine environment as the monument. And there's concerns even that some of those metals could cause an algae bloom. So these are the kind of concerns that people are trying to find out more. The Coast Guard is involved here. The company, by the way, is Element Environmental. They cannot comment on what's going on because of the investigation. But Nathan Eagle in his story reports that there are some concerns that have been raised about this company before. They found a lot of fishing line nets, for example, near the wreck. So we're trying to figure out what happened there.
Meanwhile, as that investigation continues, what about just a salvage operation?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going to have to happen. And there's concerns that basically there's a lack of compliance with trying to follow all the rules that govern the monument. As we've long talked about, it's a site of rare fish, of endangered seals, coral reefs, and so forth. But you know what? Another thing about Curry Atoll, it's also the site of a lot of shipwrecks. It's a very dangerous area. And as part of the preservation of that area, is to preserve it as a heritage site.
All right, well, we'll wait to see what happens if they really do have a salvage operation scheduled sometime soon and what that means. I thought there was supposed to be one later on this month, but go back
right,
and check
that's
that
what they're,
one.
That's correct. That's what they're going to push for, and we'll give you an update as soon as we have more, Beth.
Okay, thanks, Chad, and we'll talk to you in the morning, as always.
So, all right, like to.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. Next fall will mark the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. It was a letter written by then Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour, expressing the British government's support for a Jewish homeland in Palestine following the fall of the Ottoman Empire. The letter also said that, quote, nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities. In the 100 years since, including the years following the UN's creation of the State of Israel, whether and how Palestinians and Jews could live together has been fraught with violence. Bridging past with present is part of the work of Hebrew University's Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian. She's the first Palestinian woman to be tenured in the Israeli university system. She's in Honolulu this week and joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us. This is often such a complex and deeply confusing subject for Americans in particular to take on, to be able to enter into a conversation that has so many levels. How do you people begin, or how do you help people begin to approach talking about something that is so deeply rooted in history and often so steeped in violence?
Well, that's exactly where we really need to be more humane and in touch with human needs and human suffering, because, you know, in using all sorts of so-called historical backgrounds and security issues, what I call actually in my latest book, the security theology, which is from one side the biblical claims of the sacred and the profane, and from the other side the security needs of Israel. There is so much jeopardy of Palestinian life, and there's so much human suffering, and that's exactly where I start. I look at not only what kind of suffering and what kind of criminality, but rather what is the political work of suffering. And you just started by saying that it's a complicated issue because generally, you know, people tend to put aside the Palestinian while focusing on the rights of those that biblically, they claim the land, turning God into a real estate agent, you know, dividing lands and evicting others.
For the modern context, even looking at, for example, today in the news that the U.S. has strongly condemned Israel for approving a plan for new settlements construction in the occupied West Bank. These things seem to keep resurging and ongoing. There was a time where we thought that maybe there might be a hope for peace in the region, even thinking about the recent death of Shimon Peres and going back to the Oslo Accords. But as you look at it now, what's your take on how this region can peacefully exist, if that's possible?
And, you know, usually the main claim is, you know, the need for coexistence. But I always say in order for us to coexist, we need to exist. And what we see for years and the past years, and since the establishment of the State of Israel, is that settlers are really at hand. If you look at the amount of housing demolition, of land confiscation, of Judaization of space, and my talk on Saturday, we'll really focus on Jerusalem to show what is going on in Jerusalem, because the dispossession of resources, dispossession of life, the marking of children's bodies and women's bodies as bodies that are disposable, that are unwanted, that are unhuman, is so strong. So you see it in the West Bank and the new building of settlements, but you see it in Jerusalem around my house, and you see how settlers and Jewish settlers, they feel that they have the power to evict, to demolish, to control, to write on walls. You know, beside my house, there's a church, and on the church, it was written, you know, Jesus is son of a whore, and the Christians out, Armenian out, Arabs are pigs, Muhammad is a pig. So what you see is not only the actual criminalities that the world would look at, but rather the, you know, the settlers' criminality, the state criminality that is not even acknowledged as such. And the main claim is, you know, the security for one side, but it's the total insecurity for the other. So what worries me is how can we raise our kids under such conditions of constant dispossession and constant trauma? How can you protect your kids, allow them, you know, the near walk to go to school? 7 in the morning for a Palestinian child in Silwan or in Rat El Amud is not 7 in the morning for a Jewish child, even in settlements in the West Bank where the land is dispossessed. So the situation is extremely hard, and human suffering is what concerns me, and trauma, and especially the trauma on children, because how can we as adults tell kids, well, we're here for you and we can protect you, when we see them, we see the Israeli security pulling our kids, imprisoning them, harassing them, abusing them, and while we're standing looking unable to do anything.
Watching the violence that goes both ways, it would be easy to say that, you know, this is going to be the perpetuating system for a very long time because it has not been able to find an appropriate and peaceful solution. As you look at your house, and you mentioned some of that, and you also, because you study and focus, you know, gender crimes and the crime of femicide in particular, which we don't hear a whole lot about in the United States. We hear a lot of, you know, the top line issues. How do you draw that down into a government that seems to be, you know, fragilely constructed? And how much support do you think there is from Israelis in general for some of the issues that you bring up?
Well, you know, I more look at the behavior of the state. I do not think that all Israelis are responsible, and they are. I think that this is a state that is built on constant dispossession. It was built on constant dispossession. And you mentioned the Balfour Declaration. You know, even at that time in 1917, the Balfour Declaration stated clearly that the people in the land should not be consulted, you know. So if the claim is a land with no people for people with no land, it's not that people, that Palestinians were not there. It's that Palestinians were not considered even at that point as people, which means that the moment you dehumanize and demonize the other, it creates a very sophisticated condition for both, you know, Palestinian and Israeli parents, because the Israeli parents need to tell their kids, well, be careful. These are hateful others. These are dangerous others. So think about a parent that needs to raise their kids. on fear, and it is a production of fear, as I say in my writing. It's an industry of fear that is creating one side as fearful other that should be killed, as a terrorist other that should be, you know, evicted and that should be eliminated. And this is where the inability to build peace, because if you start when the point of departure is by you, you know, turning yourself as a person who has the right to write while the others should be evicted and exterminated, this is a wrong way to start it. But when you start in a different way while looking at each side in their eyes, that's a different start. So what I see right now is a situation with no hope, because leadership is not really being fair, to say the least, and just the Palestinian, the dispossession in all level. You know, I mean, it's not only the land, it's not only the space, it's life, the ability to have a family. In Jerusalem, some family members have birth certificates, other that were born in Jerusalem do not have it. So this kind of constant dispossession is creating an unending situation that is
Dr. Shalhoub,
embedded in the structure of oppression.
I'm sorry to say that we have to go, but thanks very much for joining this morning, Dr. Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian, who is in Honolulu this week. She's a legal scholar and currently serves as the chair of the law at Hebrew University of Jerusalem and Gender Studies Program at Mada Al Carmel, the Arab Center for Applied Social Research. She was one of Harvard Law School's 2015 Women Inspiring Change honorees, and she'll be speaking this Saturday at the Parish of St. Clement in Honolulu. More is on our Facebook page.
People.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Tens of thousands of people are gathered on Oahu's south shore to pray for peace and watch as thousands of lanterns are launched. Some carry notes. All are filled with aloha for loved ones and hope for the future. As the radiant lights move slowly across the ultramarine water, a feeling of love encompasses all who are there. Tears mix with smiles, songs are sung, strangers share hugs. This is the lantern floating ceremony held each Memorial Day at Ala Moana Beach. Sponsored by Nale Aloha Foundation, it's a way for the Shinyo and Buddhist order to give to our community. Nale Aloha offers this annual ceremony for free, but many wish to make donations. These go to the city for park beautification and provide grants for community services, all in the name of peace and unity. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Aloha, I'm Al Harrington. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio, the best in the land.
Tonight at 5, Bethany will be bringing us Town Square, and Hawaii now has a ban on sex trafficking, but it was late in coming, wasn't it?
It was late in coming. We were the last state to be able to have a ban on sex trafficking. And that we've discussed in past and this Monday when we began to talk about what happens to kids, though, who have already been trafficked. Excuse me. And if there is a way of rehabilitating kids or helping them to renew their very young lives.
Yeah.
And what's our responsibility in all of that? That conversation is going to be taken into Town Square tonight as we continue to look at how we can help kids who have already been caught up in trafficking to be able to take back their lives.
Lots of ongoing damage from that. That's tonight at 5 on Town Square. Earlier in the show, we asked you the name of the freshwater gobby that was endemic to the islands and possibly could have taken the Humuhumu Nuku Nuku Apua'a's title as state fish. The reef triggerfish was given the title of Hawaii state fish in 1985. However, due to an expiration of the law, its reign ended in 1990. Apparently, some legislators had concerns about the survey that was used to determine the public's preferred fish species, and that led lawmakers to include an initial 5-year term limit on the Humuhumu Nuku Nuku Apua'a. It seemed that no one was aware of this small bit of information, so when a group of constituents came out in favor of the Oopu, our Hawaiian stream gobby, it came as a surprise to many. But in the end, the Humuhumu Nuku Nuku Apua'a won out and held on to its title, which has now been made permanent. Congratulations to all. Robert Kruger knew the answer to that. And at 8:48, that's today's quiz. Congratulations, Robert. A T-shirt is headed your way. And if you've got a quiz for us, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
It's a convergence that probably had to happen eventually. Yoga combined with acrobatics, known as acro-yoga. Both disciplines value strength and flexibility, and those will be put to the test at a weekend-long circus camp this weekend on Maui. Amanda Ferjewel will preside over the aerial boot camp, which is open to all skill levels, and she's on the line from her Lahaina studio. Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning.
You've set a pretty ambitious course for this weekend boot camp, haven't you?
I did. We're very excited about it. It's all levels, so anyone who's never tried aerial all the way up to our very advanced acrobats were welcome to come to this camp. And we brought in several guest instructors, one who's from abroad that I flew in just this week, and as well as our own instructors and some other instructors that are here on the island. So it's going to be a really fantastic camp.
Well, the whole idea of open to all levels is what struck me, Amanda, because it seems as if it's pretty ambitious stuff there.
It is, but there is something that everyone can do. As long as you're able to hold on for dear life, you are able to do it. And a lot of the disciplines are extremely forgiving for all levels. Our aerial yoga classes are very therapeutic in a lot of ways, and they're definitely open to all levels. And there are, of course, things that are more acrobatic that require strength or a little bit more body awareness, but really all levels can participate to some extent. And even the lira, things like the aerial lira and the silks, there are definitely things that you can do as a brand newbie.
The silks, what are the silks?
So the silks are, I don't know if you're familiar with some of the shows like Ulalena or Cirque du Soleil, but they're two pieces of fabric that are separated, and you climb up on them and wrap your body in a bunch of different ways and do drops and holds, and it's beautiful and very, very challenging. But even as a beginner, I mean, I have kids as young as 14 months who participate in some way, so there's definitely things you can do even if you're not very cognizant of what's going around. So it's an amazing, amazing way to get fit and experience something that most people don't really get the opportunity to experience.
So you're doing a yoga position, but you're suspended from these silks?
Yes. So the difference between aerial yoga and aerial silks is that the aerial yoga class really focuses on using the aerial hammocks and slings in order to enhance your yoga position. So a lot of people have a challenging time with things like handstands and backbends, and this yoga swing will support you in that, so it makes it much easier to hold those longer, more difficult, challenging positions. when you're off the ground, and it allows a lot of that lymphatic drain and the benefits that you really see from yoga. Whereas aerial silk is less of a yoga practice. You're off the ground much more. An aerial yoga class, maybe you're only 3 or 4 feet off the ground, whereas the silks, you can be up to 20 or 30 feet in the air. So it's much, a little bit more dangerous, a little bit more adrenaline on that one. And it does take a lot more skill and a lot more practice to perfect your moves in an aerial silk class versus an aerial yoga, which is, like I said, much more forgiving for the brand newbie. But they both have things that you can do no matter what your skill level is.
Amanda, you said something about a lymphatic drain. What's that?
So the lymphatic system is sort of your body's natural ability to clean itself, and that's why you have a lot of people are doing those inverted poses, and that they talk about the benefits of being upside down and that spinal decompression. But the lymphatic system is just your body's way of resetting, and it only does it if you're upside down for 15 minutes at least. And so a lot of people can't be upside down for that long without support. And I don't know many people who can hold a 15-minute handstand, but you can do it in the aerial fabric because you're completely supported and you can get that spinal decompression. It just is so good for people who have, you know, chronic back pain, and it just is an amazing way to experience that anti-gravity with very little muscle requirements. So it's very special.
So you hang upside down and a lymphatic drain is the result?
Yes, it's an internal thing that happens, and it's like a reset for your body. It's a reset for your immunity system. Your body has a chance to pump blood in a way it's not used to. So it just the benefits of that anti-gravity and inversion are widely spread around in the yoga community, and it's something that's very special when you finally get an opportunity to experience it to its fullest degree.
Most people never spend any time upside down.
I know. That's why it's so good, because it's a way to experience your body in multiple planes and ranges of motion. So you're doing your lateral, your sagittal, like every part of your body is moving, and you can experience that upside down weightlessness. And not a lot of people ever really experience their bodies in that way. And I think it's really a special and amazing transformative practice.
You used a couple of terms I'm not familiar with. Did you say sagittal?
Sagittal plane, yes. So in the world of how your body works, the body mechanics, you've got a frontal plane, so you're able to walk forward, your sagittal, your side plane. So it's just the way your body moves. It has what's called different planes of motion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a term we throw around a lot, but it sort of relates to that the top of the skull, between like the parietal bones, the front and back direction of your body. So it's like when you're swinging your legs in aerial, you're going from your legs being in front of you to your legs being behind you. So it's that circular motion that is not used very often. Most people just walk forward. They walk backward occasionally. Maybe they'll walk side to side, but they don't do all the planes of motion in one workout. And that's what this is really great for. It's that circular motion that's uncommon but so beneficial for the body.
That's why dancers and acrobats and gymnasts have such great bodies, isn't it? Because they work everything out.
Absolutely. They're working their muscles from every angle, and that's what you get in an aerial situation. Just every part of your body, every tiny little muscle. People will often say, like, I didn't even realize I had that muscle. How is it hurting so much? And that's something you get in an aerial endeavor. Every muscle working. The tiny little stabilizer muscles have to really engage in order for you to fully experience and fully do the move. And it's deceiving how hard it can be when you're working just a tiny little muscle you didn't even know you had.
Yeah, it sounds it. Thanks, Amanda. It's pretty intriguing stuff.
Thank you.
Amanda Ferjewell will conduct a weekend-long circus camp and intensive aerial weekend starting Friday at the Pole Room in Lahaina, Maui. Beth Ann, I was intrigued to read that it's the 100th anniversary of the Balfour.
Or it will be next November.
Will be But the whole idea that 100 years has gone by without the expressed intention being fulfilled.
Well, and that's part of, I think, what we'll be looking at over the next year too, because that really began to set the tone when, you know, Britain entered into this. And of course, the Ottoman Empire had fallen, and then they became very instrumental in what mandates were going to happen after the First World War. And then we've seen how history has been playing out. And yet we don't go back and look at some of that and what the intent was.
We can learn a lot from that history, couldn't we?
Can't we always?
Always, exactly.
That's going to do it for us for this Thursday. Coming up tomorrow, it's not very deep history to look back and see that the rail project is having some deep problems with those plastic shims that are cracked and some of the other strands of metal that have also began to fray. We're going to take a look at this through the eyes of a professor of engineering. Amarjit Singh will be with us tomorrow morning.
And it's described as an art experience focusing on art as a tool for exploring the human and sacred connection. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any part of the show or you want some more, you can go back and take a look at our archive. You can find it on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. See you tomorrow with more of The Conversation.